My name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. I'm glad the recovery house has so many friends. I really am. We need all the support we can get. I came into the first meeting I ever attended of Alcoholics Anonymous was on the Colville Nez Perce Indian Reservation in Washington State. And I was in college. I was a junior or a senior. And I was kind of running away from home for the weekend. And we left Spokane and got out to the reservation where we could drink and smoke dope and not be noticed. And the only thing going on inside of the little Catholic church in whose attic we were staying was an AA meeting. I had never been to one. My familiarity with Alcoholics Anonymous was nil. I never read anything about you in books. I never read the book. I never saw your cult movies, you know, like The Days of Wine and Roses and I'll Cry Tomorrow and all these great identification things. The Betty F. story. I didn't know anything about you folks, but there was nothing else doing that night, and I had every intention of smoking my brains out afterwards. But I did go to the meeting, and I was very strange, because it was a place where Native Americans and Caucasians sat down at the same table and smoked the same cigarettes and drank the same black awful coffee and talked about feelings. And I had never experienced anything like that in my life. I was 21, 22, 23 years old. And a lot of the feelings talked about, no one was eloquent. I mean, no one, you know, they swore a lot and said, But I was real impressed with the feelings talked about, and I identified with a tremendous number of the feelings. The meeting lasted an hour or so. And there were so few people at the meeting, they let guests speak. And we said, gee, we sure are impressed with you people. I almost told them that I identified with a lot of their feelings, but I wasn't done yet. So instead, I just let you know how much I respected you, and I thought you were a great group, and then I went upstairs and smoked my brains out. That was in 1970 or 71. And after that, I had a few more years of practice before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the second time, or to an AA meeting, actually coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, which was in August, I think around August 18th of 1976. Since that time, I think I've learned a lot. I'll try to share a little bit of that with you, talk some about me. I travel a lot, and sometimes that's really fun, and sometimes that's a big drag. And I kind of been on the road a lot since June, and I've been to places like Santa Barbara, and I've been to places like Texas and New Mexico and Oklahoma City, and, you know, some up and some down. And I get the impression that I'm living out of a suitcase sometimes, and I get panicky, and I say, I haven't been to my home group in 4 weeks, and I'm scared, and I start to get real insecure. And I start to feel too hungry and too angry and too lonely and too tired. And last week I started feeling a lot of those things. I was in the Denver airport. I was leaving a monastery that I went to for 4 days of R&R. I never would do that before I got sober. In fact, I didn't do it at all till I was 9 years sober. I figured 9 years of good program and a sponsor like Attila the Hun, and I could probably handle a Benedictine monastery for 4 days. So I had met some good friends there and a couple people I feel very close to, and I was leaving them on last Thursday, a week ago Thursday, and I missed them. I felt some separation pain, and I was in the Denver airport, and my plane was late, and if you've been to the Denver airport, there's lots of crazy going on there. It's a big dysfunctional family there at the Denver airport. Everyone's late, and, you know, people are yelling and screaming and catatonic and having a few social drinks to ease their nerves, and I just kind of sat down in the smoking section, and I haven't had to smoke nicotine in about 9 years. Not through any choice of mine, I assure you. If I could still be doing it, I'd still be doing it. I'd believe in addiction. But I was there, and I was feeling kind of sorry for myself and lonely and disconnected and tired and a little panicky. And I looked over, and there was this man sitting next to me who was smoking a cigarette, and it was the most attractive cigarette I've seen in a very long time. And my first thought was, go and get a pack and smoke them all now. And I, you know, what I've learned to do, I'm so clever on techniques how to stay alive. I had to think it through and picture it and see it and what brand, and I had a little, you know, erotic feeling about those cigarettes. And then I said, well, let's do it tomorrow instead. Okay, so we've handled that one. The next thought, of course, was drinking. And a couple people looked like they were having a wonderful time all by themselves. And if you drink in airports, does it count? You know, I'm not trying to do that. About 5 or 6 years ago, I was in Santa Cruz going to a conference, and I went into a liquor store to buy a New York Times, and it was, they had a basket with that funny grass, phony Easter hair thing. I don't know what it's called, but it feels awful. Tastes awful, too. And in the basket were all kinds of little, tiny airplane bottles of booze. And I'm buying the New York Times, and it's a Sunday morning, and I should be very spiritual. And I look over, and my head says, what cute little bottles. What cute little tiny gins and vodkas. Those are so small they can't hurt you. Get a dozen, you know. And I'm not embarrassed that my brain works like this at all. I mean, I've gotten over that. I think around 9 years on the program, I got over that. But I let it chatter. I do not take it personally, and I walk towards the door. You know, you just do not try to talk it away. You'll lose. So we had the cigarette fantasy, and then we had the a bourbon fantasy, and the next fantasy was, why don't you kill yourself? It's Thursday, you feel a little awkward. You just left a friend of yours you'd like to spend a lot of time with, and you can't because of a lot of distance. You're going home, and there's probably 800 angry letters waiting for you and bills to pay, and, you know, you're late, and the lawn hasn't been cut in 3 weeks. Why don't you just kill yourself? Now, I'm not surprised by thoughts like that either. I mean, this is perfectly normal. Usually, we'll kill myself tomorrow. Right now, let's wait for the plane. And the plane came, we got out, and I got home, and I called my sponsor and talked to his machine. And all I have to do is let him, you know, I don't have to go into a lot of interpretation. I was in the Denver airport, I wanted to smoke, drink, and kill myself. Other than that, I'm fine. Love, Tom. Because I think we do something awful with people with a little time on the program. We deny them their humanity in flesh and blood. How can you think that? You're 5 years on the program. Because it seems like a good idea. That's how I think it. So, the survival technique is I just don't take my brain that seriously anymore. I mean, it's a bad B movie, you know, and a lot of time it just plays weirdest things. So what I'm noticing now, I noticed earlier that I'm strung out. I used to have to be for years I had to be in tremendous pain before I noticed it. And now I notice it a lot earlier, and I know I need some time off. In fact, I got home Thursday night, I knew I had to cut back on some things and cancel some things and take care of some things and I have some tools the program has taught me. I'm very grateful for those. I might talk about some of those tonight. I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm real grateful that I have a place to come to. Because it's a problem for me fitting in a lot of places. I was always the smartest student in the dumb class, or the dumbest student in the smart class. And it was real hard to feel like I belonged very much of any place. When I came along too, my parents were older. I was the youngest of their kids, and they were kind of tired. So they... you kind of naturally got the feeling you were intruding because you were, you know? I really wanted to join Boy Scouts. They explained to me they had already done that. And I understand that now. I mean, but at the time, I just felt real odd and like I didn't fit in and didn't belong. So Alcoholics Anonymous has been a crucial place where I've learned how to belong in some ways. And there are a couple of kinds of arrogance. I have a lot of arrogance. And it's one of those words that we talk about, you know, on program. Arrogance. My understanding of it is that there are two flavors of it. And the first flavor of arrogance is I'm better than you. You know, you are garbage. I am sensational. I have better legs, you know. I wear better clothes. I have better family. I've got more money in the bank. And therefore, we have nothing in common. Therefore, I end up isolated, alone, and in my room. Right. Now, that's not my arrogance. And I don't think it has ever been my arrogance. My experience of arrogance is the second flavor of arrogance, which is I'm worse than all of you. And we have nothing in common. And where you are decent, hardworking people, I am garbage. And where do I end up? Alone, in my room, isolated. Both flavors of arrogance get us into our room alone, you know, and so both of them kill us, but it's different kinds, and sometimes it took me a while to notice variety number two as arrogance. You know, I mean, I am worse than you. Oh, yes, I am. You know? Yeah, well, I did it 10 times. You know, that kind of stuff. And the great freedom for me in recovery was the realization that you and I have a lot in common. Also lots of differences. Hooray, yes, true. But lots and lots in common. And when I started going into the fellowship and paying attention to people and listening to people talk, I was 29 years old when I got sober. I had just finished my second year of theology. I knew a lot and could do very little. So there was a real tension between the way my head worked and the way my life functioned. And I would go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous convinced that if you knew who I was, you'd ask me to leave. To protect the organization, you know. That was the basic feeling. At the same time, I don't have a great drunkalogue. And I heard some great drunkalogues. I heard just some sensational people. There was a guy at a meeting in San Francisco. He was a longshoreman named Frank. Shortest qualification I ever heard. I heard him the other night in Berkeley, and he went into about 40 minutes of what was it like on the waterfront. He's been sober 41 years. I mean, he got sober the year before I was born. He was 28 years old. He was in the general strike in San Francisco in 1934, drunk as a lord, and spent a lot of time in jail, you know, for a lot of things that seemed like a good idea at the time. But the shortest qualification I ever heard was Frank one night in San Francisco. He said, I drank till I killed a man. Does anyone have a topic? I don't know how to compete with something like that. And I'd hear people talk about lots of drugs they did. One woman in L.A. at Cedars-Sinai Hospital spent the entire time describing for us the different colors of her pills, which is wonderful, but I've never done them. So I have no idea what she's talking about. I don't know reds, blues, yellows. You know, she's talking Greek to me. If she had talked feelings, I would have connected all the way down the line. But I don't know reds, blues, yellows. And people have done jail time, and people have been married a lot. I've never spent a night in jail. I have never gotten a ticket for drunk driving. I drove drunk for years, but I never got a ticket for drunk driving. I've never gotten a tattoo. Well, this is real embarrassing. I'm what you call a sissy drunk. I have never gotten a tattoo. Real embarrassing. When I was hospitalized for the slight problem with alcohol, there were women and men in the ward I was locked up in. I was the only one there without a tattoo. And I was the only person there with all of my body parts still on. They had legs gone and hands gone and arms gone, noses gone. So I kind of walked down the hall with one hand over my arm, hoping they'd think a tattoo was underneath, and I limped. And I was also an active church member. You know, I mean, I didn't even have that particular thing. So I felt like I was scum. And yet on the outside, I was functioning just fine.
sort of.
And it was very confusing for me until someone explained that the phrase that got used, Skid Row, is between our ears. And the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And what was going on inside of me was I was dying. And I was dying by inches. And I could have gone on dying by inches for 30 years or 40 years or 50 years, or I could have died that night on my own vomit. You know, but I was definitely involved in the process of dying. Emotionally, I was a shambles. I was very shut down. Physically, I was in some trouble. I was very, very depressed. Food hadn't stayed down in a while. Food, you know, let's identify food. Hershey bars are not food. What would stay down for me towards the last 6 months or so, I was a student in Berkeley. We had a market on the corner called Seven Palms, which we renamed Seven Thieves. And I could get a can of tomato soup from there for 23 cents. That shows you how long ago that was. And you don't even have to take tomato soup out of the can to eat it. It's a wonder drug. So that would usually stay down. And hot dogs. And I would go to Top Dog, which was the headquarters for the Anarchist Party. And you would say, I'd like a Polish sausage, down with the state. And they would give you a Polish sausage and you'd eat it. So tomato soup, hot dogs, plus, of course, nicotine, caffeine, and alcohol. And I sort of lived on that for the last 6 months. And so when I got into recovery, it was very uncomfortable starting to eat again. I can remember the first morning in the hospital, and they expected you to eat breakfast. Now, I wasn't hungover, but I had never eaten breakfast. And I tried food, and I would just get nausea. This wave of nausea would come over me. And then lunch and the same thing, and then dinner, and some of it would stay. But there was no interest in the smell of... When I was drinking, we had someone in the neighborhood that got this recipe for a lamb curry. And I don't know whether you've been involved with lamb curry. But it has a way of staying in the air for a long time. And I'd walk by her house on a daily basis on my way to Seven Thieves Market, and I'd throw up with this smell of lamb curry. So the concept of food I understood, but it had nothing to do with me. And when I was in the hospital, they said, a real good sign of your recovery is when you can start eating recognizable food three times a day. And I just, that seems, what does that have to do with recovery? You know, why don't I just stop drinking? Well, as someone pointed out to me, there is a lot more to not drinking than not drinking. See, if all we had to do was stop drinking, we'd never relapse. But a lot of us relapse because there's a lot of other stuff out there. Basic taking care. And food was the big, lesson number two was right on the, it was called washing. With soap. Daily. Now again, I had nothing against the concept. I'm all for the concept. But towards the end of my drinking and using, I was pretty tired. And it was, I lived in a dorm and it was exhausting to have to get up, get a towel, open the door, down the hall. My door was a turn door. You turn, and then you had to go down the hall, and the bathroom door was a push door. You had to push that open. And then you had to put the towel down and get the water right. And then you had to get in, and one, my hair was a lot longer. You had to wash all of that stuff, and then you had to dry off afterwards and go back to your room. And I'm so tired, I just passed out again. So I didn't do it very much. And in the hospital, they told me that as a sign of my commitment to recovery, I should bathe every day. I wrote that down. And they said, when you know, you're going to meetings, you're working your program, which we'll talk about in a minute. You know, what else do you do all day? All right, we've got bathing, we've got eating. Brushing teeth was introduced. Dental floss was introduced as a fine point of brushing teeth. Then they said, and when you get real self-confident, you might want to look at a haircut. Let's not rush. But you might want to look at a haircut. Laundry. Real big concepts. And I found, for a while, was doing any of these things, they took all of the emotional and psychic energy I had was to do stuff like that. And, you know,
well, what about my relationship?
Why don't we wait until we wash more regularly? I bumped into people who think recovery's quick. You know, and they'll say things like, well, in your first year, you should take care of your physical stuff. In your second year, take care of your emotional stuff. In your third year, take care of your spiritual stuff. You may be able to do that if you're very, 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 very fast. My experience has been that the first 7 years of my recovery were absolutely bare bones, fundamental early years of my recovery. And it took me 7 years to start learning basic things like don't argue with your brain. Don't argue. Just walk to the next room. Call your sponsor. Brush your teeth. Don't argue with... Hungry, angry, lonely, tired, serious concepts. Not just for newcomers. You know, I think the most profound spiritual advice you can give anybody is don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. You know? It's very difficult, this recovery stuff. It's simple, but not easy. And it's ongoing, and that just... I don't think that's fair. I thought that when I hit 10 years clean and sober, they should put my picture up there next to Bob and Bill's. And they didn't. They encouraged me to go to a meeting that day. I just don't think that's fair. Oh, my. Anyway, this recovery stuff, it is an ongoing thing. I mentioned program, and where I got sober in Berkeley, and so we use, to me, that's normal. Okay, that's what shows you a lot. And I travel to other places, and what goes on there is normal for them too, and I have to grant that fact. They say in the program that love and tolerance is our code. That may be true, but one of the gifts I have is judging. And I judge quick and sure. And one of the differences now is I no longer have to announce it to the group, but I notice. And a year or two ago, I was asked to go down to Alabama to talk at the Heart of Dixie Conference, and the hospitality there is absolutely gracious and gentle, but it's a different culture from what I'm used to. I live in a very racially integrated neighborhood, and we have retired people and people with little kids and lesbian couples and priests. I mean, it's a very strange neighborhood. But to me, it's absolutely normal, and I went down to Montgomery, Alabama, and everyone was gracious, and they asked odd things. They asked things like, have you been to the place where President Davis was sworn in? I said, no, I've just gotten into town. I've missed it. They thought I would go there before I went to the hotel. One of them said, have you been... She knew I was a priest, and she said, have you been to the Episcopal Church? They always ask church questions, think you're a priest. Have you been to the Episcopal Church to see the place where Jefferson Davis prayed every Sunday morning during the War of Northern Aggression? I said, no. And then I overheard two women talking, and one said to the other, I hear our speakers are Yankee. I thought this only happened in movies. I really did. And there it was, right there. So there are lots of differences. You know, there are lots of differences. I don't know what that has to do with anything, except that when I came in, Berkeley, I guess, the Berkeley notions and what I think is normal, what happened, people talked about program a lot. And my first thing with program, I mean, I do this a lot. It's a defect of character. And someone explained to me a defect of character is a place that needs healing. And that's all it really is. It's not the end of the world. It's just another place that needs healing. But one of mine is this. Before I start anything, before I try anything new, I have to learn all about it. All about it. So rather than learning how to swim by jumping in the pool, I'll buy a lot of books on pools. You know, and Olympic gold medalists in the pools, and read Mark Spitz's life story. That. Instead of jumping in the pool. Getting interested in the form of meditation, and I'll go to a spiritual bookstore and buy every book on the subject. Now, I don't have to read them. I just have to have them. And then I can say, oh, sure, yes, I've seen that book. By John Smith. Is, oh, yes, surely. I've done this with program stuff. Now I go, buy the big book, buy the 12x12, get all the new literature, make a little shrine in my room, and leave. Can I get a picture of Dr. Bob Plant in my room? That is not the program. That's called idolatry. And it's substituting something false before something that is real. And it'll kill us. It'll just kill us. When we're talking program, what we're talking are the simple, concrete, factual, everyday things that save your life. That save my life. But I wanted to figure it all out first, alone in my head, which is where I go a lot when I'm confused. And why I go to my head when I'm confused baffles me more than you, because it's the last place to go, I assure you. I think I'll think this through. Oh, good, Tom. I got a sponsor. That's part of the program, is having a sponsor, by the way. If you don't have a sponsor, you're not working the program. If you don't have a sponsor, turn to the person next to you tonight and say, will you be my sponsor? And then exchange phone numbers and try it tomorrow. You know, call, see. Well, people in Berkeley kept saying, you have a sponsor? You have a sponsor? You have a sponsor? And I didn't. And I'm a people pleaser. So I got a sponsor so I could say, yes, yes, I have a sponsor. What they don't tell you is what to do with your sponsor once you've got him. Do you move in? Does he pay your bills? Do you pay his? Is this another father? You know, I mean, Dad, what should I do? Can I have the car tonight, Dad? Is it your best friend? I mean, what is this sponsorship role? Anyway, I asked a man to be my sponsor. I was 29. I was very conscious about age. Now I'm completely over that defective character, being 40. But at the time, I was very conscious. I thought I was real young to be an alcoholic, you know, and I was real embarrassed. What was fortunate was, around the time I got sober, 6 months before and after, a bunch of women and men, mid-20s to mid-30s, came into the program. And I started listening to them, went to meetings where they went. They were all my sponsor for a while. There was one man I greatly respected named Gene, but I was not worthy of him. So I didn't ask him to be my sponsor, and he scared me besides. Because he talked about the true things. He talked about true things in a meeting. You know, he can't stand that. So I asked someone that... Gene was the sponsor for a man named James, and James scared me a lot less. And James was younger than me and had a lot of tattoos. So I asked James to be my sponsor. And, you know, what do you do? Well, here's what we do in Berkeley response. At least this is what we say at meetings. You ask someone to be your sponsor, you get their phone number, and then you wait. And you wait for a crisis. And then you wait until 3 a.m. And then you call. And you say, I'm having a terrible crisis, or words to that effect. And then they're supposed to tell you something wise and wonderful. And they're supposed to be very grateful to hear your voice. And you should have a pad and paper by the phone, crayon if necessary, but, you know, anything to write with. And they're supposed to say wise things, and you write them down, and then you take them to your home group and quote your sponsor. My sponsor. So I thought that's how it worked. I went to Los Angeles when I was a year sober. When I was a year sober, I was a mess. And I was a mess because it was August. I was leaving Berkeley to go back to work. I was going back to the classroom in Los Angeles. I did not know anybody sober. I was depressed on my first birthday. I think I'm the only person in North America depressed on their first birthday. because it had been a year without a drink or a joint or a pill, and I didn't feel any different. The only difference was that it had been a year without a drink or a joint or a pill. And someone said, "That's real good, Tom. That's real good, Tom." Oh, that enough of a difference to make a difference? Yes. So I knew I was going to go to L.A., and I was going back to work, and that was an awful circumstance. I was afraid to go back to my profession. I'm trained as a teacher, and I was afraid to go back to the classroom. I was afraid of the kids. I was afraid that they wouldn't like me. They'd see through me. I can't talk straight. I don't know how to deal with pressure without alcohol and drugs. I don't know if I can get through Christmas. What about graduation parties next June? Questions like that. So I wrote the Cardinal Archbishop of Los Angeles, and I said, I'm going to be ordained a priest next year. I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous a year. I would like to connect with a sober priest in Los Angeles. Are there any? Love, Tom. And Cardinal Manning wrote back and said, call Terry R. So I got the message and filed it away. He didn't say anything about him. Didn't say what his politics were. Didn't say how big he was. Didn't talk about, does he play sports? All I knew is call Terry R. Got to L.A. on a Friday, went to a meeting, went to two meetings on Saturday, went to two meetings on Sunday, called him on Monday, said, I need a sponsor. Will you be my sponsor? Now, I asked him to be my sponsor because I needed one, not because he was worthy of my being his sponsee. And he said, how long you been in L.A.? And I said, Friday. He said, been to any meetings? I said, 5. He said, I'll be your sponsor. And it's clear you're desperate enough to work the program. And we began this relationship, which is still going on. But I think what we do sometimes with sponsors, like I did this with James. I wanted a combination of Jesus Christ and the Renaissance man. So I'd go to meetings with this checklist. Oh, no, not him. Next. And I was always evaluating. I want someone who's really wonderful. You don't need someone really wonderful. You just need someone who's not drunk. Who hopefully has some common sense and who's been around the track for a while and will let you make mistakes. That could be a sponsor. Terry, this is not breaking his anonymity. It's telling you how desperately ill he is. In dealing with me, he uses a lot of Al-Anon. That other program that gets a lot of sick people well, like me. Because he does, as my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, he does not believe he has a right to protect me from my pain. And he doesn't think he has a right to make sure I don't make mistakes. I call him and say, should I do A or should I do B? And he says, well, try one. But what if I'm wrong? Promptly admit it. Once I was trying to explain something to him, and I don't know if you have to do this with your sponsor, but sometimes in talking to mine, he's so desperately ill that I have to use real small words and talk slowly so he gets the idea, And I was trying to explain this thing to him, and it basically, the point was why I was different and unique and why I could get away with doing something that nobody else could. And that any other human being who did this was garbage, but on the other hand, I'm different. And I talked and talked and explained, and he said, he listened, said, possible, doubt it. What do you mean possible, doubt it? He said, well, you might be so unique you can get away with it. No one else has, but you might be a new species, I don't know. Try it, and if it blows up, give me a call. And I tried it, and it blew up, and I gave him a call, And he didn't then say, well, now you failed, you disgusting person. He says, well, why don't you go to a meeting and take your sponsor out to lunch? I mean, it's one of very practical stuff. Sponsorship. Anyway, with James, I called James, and I was real nuts, and I was waiting to do a lot of stuff with him, and I called him. I was in crisis, which I was a lot. And I said, James, I'm in crisis. He said, what step are you on?
What am I on? What are you talking about?
My program at the time consisted of washing regularly, bathing. Wait, good. These are not bad things. They do help. Laundry, do laundry, socks, you know, white socks in one load, black socks in the other. The real subtle points of laundry.
Steps?
I was also going to a ferocious number of meetings. Lots of meetings. I was somewhere this past year and someone said, you know, we do a great mistake. We do a disservice to newcomers when we say go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Because they then think at the end of 90 days, they're well. He said, instead we should say go to 100,000 meetings in your first year. I like that. Year? Anyway, I was going to an awful lot of meetings, and I was not drinking in between meetings, and I was not using no dope. I'm going to mention that for just a second, because both in the big book and in other literature, it talks about that. In the big book, it talks about Dr. Bob Smith's use of amphetamines. That is in our literature. And Bill Wilson's use of sedatives, he called them. We call them downers. And they both use them a lot. And they saw fit to mention it in the literature. I think we can, too. In the chapter called Dr. Bob's Nightmare, I love this chapter. He says, and this is a man who's, you know, a doctor. He says, over the next few years, this is on page 175, I developed two distinct phobias. One was the fear of not sleeping. I had that one for years. Anyone else have that one? Fear of not sleeping? Okay, lots of us. And the other was the fear of running out of liquor. I lived in a Jesuit community. I never had that fear. It's impossible. Absolutely impossible. Can't do it. Not being a man of means, I knew that if I did not stay sober enough to earn money, I would run out of liquor most of the time. Therefore, I did not take the morning drink, which I craved so badly, but instead would fill up on large doses of sedatives to quiet the jitters, which distressed me terribly. Occasionally, I would yield to the morning craving, but if I did, it would be only a few hours before I'd be quite unfit for work. This would lessen my chances of smuggling some home that evening, which in turn would mean a night of futile tossing around in bed, followed by a morning of unbearable jitters. During the subsequent 15 years, I had sense enough never to go to the hospital if I'd been drinking. But swacked on pills every morning for 15 years. No problem, not him. No, we don't talk about that here. Let me see. Then we have, oh, here's Bill's story, chapter 7. For those of you who read the first 10 pages of the book, you'll run across this. On page 6, somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leapt. He was a little nervous about committing suicide. So he thought if he was on the second floor, he'd hurt less if he jumped out the window. He was nervous. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. You know, yes, it's a wonderful combination. Anyway, I had been smoking non-habit-forming marijuana every day for 7 years. And at my first meeting, someone sat me down and said, here we go to meetings, we don't drink, we don't use, period. And I was so broken and worn out and burned out and exhausted and dumb that I just believed them. And I was so stupid when I got here, as a matter of fact, I didn't know you could leave if you didn't like the rules. I thought if you're going to do it, you do it that way. So I didn't like it, but I did it. So when James said, what step are you on? Well, I'm going to a lot of meetings, and I'm not drinking, and I'm not using. But I didn't say that. I said, well, I guess I'm on step one. And he said, what's step one? And I was real glad I had the phone then, because I could flip to chapter 5. I knew it was in chapter 5. Because they read it at every meeting. You know, rarely have we seen. Oh, give me a break. Who cares?
And I said, well, step one says that I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. That's what it says. He says, no, it doesn't. I was a graduate student at this time. And I figured, well, what he wanted, and in Berkeley, mind you, what he wanted me to do was put it into my own words. You know, what does it mean to you? So, like, my sponsor was asking me to do a collage on the 12 steps, you know. What color does the first step remind you of? You know? It's hard to think like that straight, you know, really, but oh. The fourth step makes me think of saxophone. So I reworded it, and I said, well, I guess step one says that I acknowledged that I had no control over booze and dope and that my life had become a mess. He said, no, it doesn't. I said, what does it say, James? And he said, if you look real carefully at the 12 steps, nowhere in there does the word I appear. He says, we admitted, we came to believe, we made a searching, we made a list, we continued to take, we sought through prayer, and having had, we. He said, Tom, if you're ever going to get well, you're going to have to leave your room and join the group. I hate that. I still hate that. Because, again, I have this notion that I should reach a point where, you know, I just transcended the human experience. And now I'm a spiritual being, and don't get angry, and don't sweat, and don't pee. I just... I'm just an open channel for God's grace in my life. If you ever hear me talk like that as if I meant it, put your hand on your wallet. This is a flesh and blood program dealing with flesh and blood people. One of the things I have in my brain bone, and again, it's a defective character, a place that needs healing. I keep on thinking that men should be able to handle their problems alone. And my ideal image of a man is the Marlboro Man. Who's on the program, by the way. And, it, you know, I just, across the ways from Madison Avenue, this thing got me when I was a kid that said, you know, when life gets complicated, you get on your horse and you go out to the high Sierras and you have a cigarette by yourself and figure it out. And James told me that if I was ever going to get well, I had to learn to take my horse to a meeting. Awful. Awful. I hate it. So step one, you know, this is something we do together. You know, for years I knew I had a problem. But again, I was unique, and I was worse than you. But when I find out that we have a problem, there's tremendous hope there. Because then we can talk about it. And if you have gone through it before me, there's a chance I can follow through after you. I mean, someone, I heard this, it may have been Santa Barbara this past summer, I'm not sure, but they said the reason AA works is because we're not all nuts on the same day. We all get to take turns, you know, but we're not all nuts on the same day. And, you know, it's a program for us, and of course I had God problems, but I had more problems between you and me than I had between me and God. And I was so embarrassed to be me. And my problem with that is...
Well, what am I going to figure out God?
I am God's first gift to me. First gift. You are God's second gift to me. If I have a tremendous amount of difficulty with the gift, I'm going to have a little difficulty with the giver. I had to learn that I not love myself fashion,
I had to learn that I deserved an even break. I deserved a fair break. I was one of the folks just like you were.
Then I can start dealing with God.
So I kind of had to do something special in between steps one and two. Maybe it was part of my coming to believe process. But before I could come to believe in God, I had to come to believe in me. And this, it was God's...
I didn't do this by myself in my room.
I did it at meetings. And it was God's grace working on me. I was at a meeting in Berkeley on a Wednesday night at the Berkeley... at the Wild Bunch, sometimes also called the Open Ward. And I had this realization. And the realization was that everybody in the room had a right to be there. I was in the room. Therefore, I had a right to be there too. You know, equal rights. And so I find myself very sensitive around our third tradition. You know,
I mean, we say the only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking.
This third tradition, where is it? After tradition two, Tom.
Good.
It says our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism, hence we may refuse none who wish to recover. I have to accept that absolutely. Because if anybody can be kept out of these rooms, I can be kept out of these rooms. And I think we're very subtle in who we exclude. And I'm someone who excludes. I mean, like I say, judgment is one of my gifts. And I'll say, well, I'd be more than happy to let that particular creep in, but she's not honest.
You know?
Or he's too tall. Or he's one of those.
He's one of those. Do you know what people will say if we let people like him in our meeting?
Yeah, they're going to say he's so desperate to recover, he's going to your meeting. That's what he's going to say. I find I get an ageist thing. Like, I thought I was the youngest alcoholic in the history of the world that had to get sober at 28. At my home group, we're very close to an adolescent treatment facility. And so we get groups of 15-year-olds, 10, 12 of them. And what 15-year-olds, by and large, do at meetings is sit there, smoke nonstop, and say, fuck a lot. Which gets them sober. Well, what I found myself doing is being very paternalistic, you know. And this group, they were starting to ruin my meeting. I mean, we have, you know, people in their 30s and 40s, mature folk like me. And these people with new sobriety, give me a break. You know, most of us have been sober a long time, and what are these newcomers doing, ruining our meeting with their silly questions and stupid attitudes? And someone, he said it for me, he started saying, well, now, you know, you 15-year-olds, you're real lucky to get into AA before you get into real trouble. And one of these kids, they don't take a lot of shit, you know. One of these kids spoke next and said, you know, my name is so-and-so, I'm 15 years old, I have no family, I have no job, I have no place to live, and my liver is shot. I'm in real trouble. Will you let me come in? The only requirement for me, you know, we can hold no one back, you know. So that's one of those things I believe in. Anyway, this the hardest step for me ever to take has been the second step, because I don't think I can get well. My first thought is I am sicker than you. The only person sicker than me that I know of in the fellowship is my sponsor. And that's why he's my sponsor. He is the one person on earth who can't judge me. Because I always know that he is really sick. And he's in desperate need of the program and desperate need of recovery. And he's, you know, 6 beers away from a wet brain. I know that. Therefore, I can trust him completely. I can trust him because he's not here just because he has nothing better to do. He's here because he has a desperate commitment to his recovery. I trust that. I just trust that. I knew you could get well. I didn't think I could get well. And I was standing on a corner in Berkeley talking to a very tall Al-Anon one day, and this is around a year of sobriety, maybe 9 months. And I had to come to the realization that if I was going to get well, I had to take the second step.
But I didn't believe in the second step. I wasn't sure what it meant. Makes no difference. Take it anyway.
It doesn't say understand the second step. It says take the second step. And the power greater than myself. And I always go, when's this power greater than myself take over? And I know there are a variety of religious experiences. There are a variety of spiritual experiences. What gets the headlines are the real quick ones. And there are historical incidents of people being knocked off their horse, though he wasn't on a horse on the road to Damascus. I mean, there are spiritual instances like that of quick change in people's lives. This has not been my story. And people, Bill and Bob and a lot of the early fellowship, had exposure to kind of a fundamentalist Protestantism, Southern Baptist tradition, where quick, sudden conversion happened and people would be filled with the Holy Spirit and speak in tongues and run around the room and be saved. Well, this doesn't happen to most of us. It happens to some, and that's wonderful. But there are a variety of ways of doing this. So in the back of the book, they had to write a blurb, Appendix 2, on the spiritual experience. What does it look like? And it says, among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, especially in the southern states, are by no means the rule. No, that's my interpretation. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety because they develop slowly over a period of time. And I would prefer the quick. But it's a slow, slow transformation. And what happened, I was waiting for this, being filled with a lot of, and feeling God's presence and walking hand in hand with the Creator. Instead, what happened was that about 9 months sober, I was sitting in a meeting in Berkeley, and I came to that realization, bonk. Not that I was 9 months sober, 10 months sober, but the realization that the craving to use, the obsession for me to use, had been removed. And I didn't know when. I mean, what I remember is being like this a lot. And going to meetings a lot and being real tight a lot and being afraid to laugh because I was afraid if I started I wouldn't stop. And being afraid of what do you do after meetings and how do you fill up your time and what do you do all day to make sure you're not drinking and how many times can you shower during the day to make sure you're not drinking. And I was so afraid that if I relaxed for just a second I'd get drunk and after meetings people just taste bourbon and I'd walk and I'd walk and I'd walk and I didn't know what to do, just fill up the time and fill up the time and fill up the time until the bars closed. That was a daily experience for me for months. And all of a sudden, I realized it had been months since I had done that. And I came to the realization that I was being restored to sanity. I came to believe, not feel. I came to believe that a power greater than myself was starting to restore me to sanity. Little by little by little by little. Step 3, making a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. I would like to speak for just a moment on behalf of struggling with God. I get a little guilty, not over many things, but every so often I hear someone who so trusts God completely that God is their best friend. And that when they're the slightest ill at ease, they turn it over and it gets all better. I wish I were like that. But I still kind of look at God with a yellow eye. And I find that what I do with God a lot is wrestle. I mean, Indian wrestle, kind of... And or tug of war, it's back and forth and back and forth, and I'll trust God up to a point and then stop. And say, well, we've gotten this far, but I don't know about tomorrow. You've taken care of alcoholism, drug addiction, a lot of other craziness, but what about X? Maybe you're not strong enough. Maybe you're not smart enough. I don't know. We'll see. This summer, in Santa Barbara, I've been in active ministry. I've been a priest for 9 years. And one of the things on my program within my own religious order is to take this kind of time and go on a 30-day retreat. 30 days of silence. 30 days one-on-one with a director who leads you through
what are called the spiritual exercises of Ignatius Loyola, which is the Jesuit spiritual tradition. Lots of reflection, lots of prayer, meditation.
I was real resistant to go into this. I didn't say, oh, thank God, me and God alone in the room, what a way to spend the summer. What I was afraid of most was that I would find myself alone with God and undergo a sudden transformation, and I wouldn't recognize myself on the other end of the 30 days. I was real afraid of being lost. I was real afraid. I wanted to hug the shore, and they said, "What? Go on to the deep. It's okay, let go, trust God." So I went to a meeting a day. Sometimes I went to two meetings a day to ground me and let me know it was all okay, and then we'd kind of spend some time with God. And I found for the 30 days of meditation and prayer and all the other stuff that went into it, some of them were wonderful, and for four of them I was suicidal. Absolutely hated being there, knew nothing would work, it was all over, who cares, what program, God who, let's get out of town, can't stand this shit one more second. And I started getting panicky, you know, because I was afraid of, it's 2 weeks into the retreat, here I am praying a lot, you know, trying to meditate, turn it over, read the literature, read that stupid 24-hour day book again, all right, we'll try it again. Maybe this time it'll take. I mean, see, I just don't think God's grace works with me. And it was 2 weeks, and I wasn't noticing change. And I was starting to panic. And I was starting to, here I am again beyond God's grace. Here I am one more time cut off from the community. One more time is just not going to work. I'm going to go through the motions and be an absolute hypocrite again for the 8,000th time. And I just got panicky and I said, this is in Santa Barbara, I was going to get in the car and drive back to Oakland Sunday night and just lock my door. Get alone where I belong. And one of the tools I've learned to use in the program is before I do that, go to a meeting. Went to the Sunday night speakers meeting in Santa Barbara. I knew no one there. I've never hung out there. Zillions of people. They're all best friends. Hello, how are you? I didn't know anybody. I stood in the back and kind of obsessed. And I said, I'm going to wait till the meeting's over. And if I'm still panicky and alienated and hostile and wrong, this is 11 years sober, I'm going to drive back to Oakland. Forget this spiritual stuff. Time to go. And all of a sudden, a man walked into the room. I haven't seen him, but I knew he was on the program. He was with me at Berkeley. He was at the Episcopalian school. I was at the Jesuit school. He's 3 years sober. He walked in. His name is Gordon. He didn't see me. He stood right here next to me. Back to me talking to a lady. I noticed that. But that's not enough. Not enough. 3 seconds later, another man walks into the room. Someone I taught in 1971. Sober 4 years. Didn't even know he was in town. Hadn't seen him since he graduated from high school. Walked over here, stood next to me on this side with his back to me. He didn't even see me. So I reached out, like that. And I was not in a position of being verbal. Let's chat about my problem. It's pre-verbal. All I'm feeling is panic, and I need physical contact. And this was a jam-packed meeting full of Santa Barbara hysterical people. And on the side in the non-smoking section, of course, there are 3 empty seats. I sat in the middle. Terry was on one side, Gordon on the other. I kept on to them. The woman who spoke at the meeting spoke to me exactly about exactly everything I was feeling because it had been going on with her for 4 days. Now, see, that kind of stuff scares the hell out of me. Because, see, I don't feel God's presence a lot, but I believe in God's presence because of coincidences like that. The woman talking about my particular hysteria and the 2 men on the program in Santa Barbara that I could trust to be with show up. And we talked a long time, and they basically let me know it's all okay. Just don't drink or use or run away today. Don't smoke, don't commit suicide, don't drink bourbon. You know, be here. In your own skin, and one day at a time, we get transformed into better channels. You know, better channels. I'm over time. Step 3, and just a thing on 3, because I don't think step 3 is when we get a doctorate in theology.
God, as we understand God, I better understand God.
No one understands God.
No one does. I mean, we have some insights. Most of them agree. You know, there is one God. Shema Yisrael Adonai Elohenu Elohenu Echad. There is but one God, the Jews say. You know? And the Muslims, La ilaha illallah. There is no God but God. And in the Christian tradition, you know, God is the source. You know, and in the Hindu, there are many ways of understanding God, but we get little glimpses. Okay? Step three is an action step. And the action is mine. And the action is for me to do footwork, we say a lot. And what's footwork for me? It's three things. I've seen a lot of people get well who have great problems with God. Like I said, I have great problems with God. Not great, I have petty problems with God. It's the same petty stuff that I've always had with God. I just don't think God knows enough. I really don't. I mean, can I trust someone like that? You know, I just don't know. Nikos Kazantzakis is a Greek writer that won the Nobel Prize. Well, he wrote Zorba the Greek and a couple other things. And in one of his books, I think it's his Report to Greco, when he was a young man, he was very zealous for the truth. And he went to on Mount Athos, which is the holy place for Greek Orthodoxy. And he went to the oldest monastery to find the oldest monk. And he sat down with the oldest monk and he wanted answers. And he said, all right, old man, tell me everything about your life. What's it all about? What's it mean? And the old monk, who was 1,000 years old, said, well, my life has two parts. And the first part of my life, I wrestled with the devil. And Kazantzakis said, what happened? And the old man said, I won. And Kazantzakis said, well, what about the second part of your life? And the old man said, I'm wrestling with God. And Kazantzakis said, why? And the old man said, because I hope I'll lose. Makes great sense to me. You know, makes great sense to me. So we go back and forth. Anyway, I think step three, in my understanding, has three basic parts to it. Part one of turning it over is I've got to show up. I've got to show up. I didn't show up for years, even when I was there. Woody Allen says that 80% of life is showing up. I think that's 80% of recovery. I have to get out of my isolation. I have to get out of my room. I have to get out of my head and make some connection with other human beings. Show up talk. What should I do next? Show up somewhere. A meeting, a relationship, lunch, a job on time. I mean, show up somewhere. And so I try to do that. Especially if I get real confused and I do not know what to do next, which is about every 28 days. I don't know what to do next. They said, next year. I said, no, next. Showing up. Part two of that is once I'm there, I have to pay attention. You know, before I discovered alcohol and non-habit forming marijuana, I used fantasy and I used shutting down to survive. Fantasy. Fantasy's fine. As long as we know it's fantasy and we can visit it, it helps us get through some really weird situations. It enhances. I'm all for fantasy. But I don't want to live there. I want it to enhance this life, not have me escape from this life. And shutting down, this was real strange to me. I think codependents feel it a lot more than dependents. I'm a co, believe me. It was real uncomfortable and I couldn't leave the room, so I'd leave. No, I don't know where I go. But it happens even at AA meetings when they read chapter 5. Rarely have we seen, I'm gone. I don't know where I go. But I come back with could and would have thought, gone. I'm back in the room. Where was I? Gone. Shut down. We were talking once about this. I mean, I thought these were like sober blackouts is what I thought they were. And I have them. And it's when I'm uncomfortable, I leave. And it's very subtle. Because I don't want you to know I'm gone. So I've learned a lot of clever ways of looking like I'm paying attention, but I'm out. I have been to weddings. I have done weddings I have no recollection of. Sober. I didn't like the couple. I have to learn to be here. And a lot of prayer and meditation is my learning how to be here. Learning how to be. So breathing, concentration,
some Zen has been real helpful with that. Some real learning how to be here now, showing up, paying attention. And the third thing I have to do if I'm going to get well is tell the truth. This doesn't mean I need to take an ad out in the New York Times, but it does mean I need to tell me what's going on. Am I confused? Am I happy? Am I shut down? Am I glad? Am I lying again? What's happening, Tom? And I can share that with my sponsor if my sponsor's having a good day. Now, if I show up, pay attention, and tell the truth, I get out of God's way so that God can do with me whatever God wants to do with me, which is none of my business. And God's will, the way my Master of Novices explained it to me in 1965 to 67, and this is a very nice old man who has never had an alcohol problem in his life, he'd say, "Gang, God's will is doing what's in front of you. Do that." And I'd say, "But I want to do something great for God." And he would say, "Tom, don't pray to do great things for God. Pray that you don't screw up the works. That's your prayer." So that's kind of my prayer. There's one more thing I want to say because I like it. It's Friday night, you know. I spent Monday and Tuesday with high school students in Los Angeles, and I talked with a whole bunch of 650 kids in Torrance and then parents of sophomores at another school on Tuesday night. And we talked a lot about alcoholism, drug addiction, use of alcohol, abuse of alcohol, how do you know, what's it mean? And a lot of these folks just get nervous, and I was trying to tell them that 80% of your kids are going to try something, relax. There's nothing you can do about that. Most of your kids will have no problem with this stuff at all. They may throw up once or twice, that is not a problem. Some may develop problems, and if so, it may be short-term, maybe long-term, and there's recovery and da-da-da-da-da, we know that stuff. Anyway, one of the parents said, "Well, what can we do to prevent our kids from having this kind of pain?" And I refrained myself from saying Al-Anon. And what makes you think you have a right to protect anybody from their own pain? How arrogant we are. But I said, what came to my mind was a wonderful thing spoken to me by a Canadian physician in recovery named Gil. And he's a physician in San Francisco, been sober for 1,000 years. And we were doing a presentation, Gil and I, to nurses and doctors and priests and nuns who worked in hospitals, which is a pretty tough group to talk to because they know everything. And we were trying to explain alcoholism to them, and Gil said this, because they said this, if we educated everyone in the third grade, can we get them to just say no? And Gil said, "No." And the person said, "Why?" And he said, "Because alcoholism, she has three phases. Phase one is the fun phase. This is when you're having fun. And it is very hard to tell a 16-year-old having fun that their liver is going to blow up in 20 years. He said, phase two is fun plus problems. This is when you're still having fun, but you start to have problems. And phase three is problems. And he said, we start to pay attention somewhere towards the end of stage two when the problems don't go away. So problems are, when am I going to stop having problems? When you're dead, maybe. The fact is, if you're a living, breathing human being, you're going to have problems. And we, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're given a place to talk about our problems. and we can connect. And I find, and my trust level is not always high. And when I got here, that's a whole other topic, and maybe next year we'll talk about trust. But if learning how to talk about my insides is not, is something I learned here from listening to women and men who should be dead get well. And feeling our pain. I find in recovery I have good days and bad days. There's some day, I'm not one of those who says that my, I can't even think, I should write this down because I'm so angry at it, I can't think it out. My worst day, what is that? How does that go? It's better than my best day. Not mine. I had some great times drinking. I had a lot of fun. And the fact is, if I could still be having fun, I'd still be having fun. But it just hasn't been fun since Nixon's first term. Hasn't been fun. And there are some awful times in recovery, and one of them is that we no longer have an anesthesia. So we get to feel our first unemployment. We get to feel our first... The first time I really had the flu... Oh, you know, you mean this is what I thought it was? The first time, and I think we continue hitting bottoms in sobriety. I mean, this is one of those things that allows us, if you don't, you never change. The first time we decide to go to a therapist in sobriety, you know, the choice is suicide or the therapist at 5 years sober, and suicide looks better. So what's your top, your fifth birthday, happy birthday to you. Do you have a topic, Tom? Let's talk about suicide and recovery.
When you go through it, someone you love dies, someone you hate dies, you go through, I mean, these are real things to feel, and we all get, the only way I can do this is if you talk about your inside, so I have permission to feel and talk about mine, and then we can walk through this nightmare. You know, and love each other a lot. So there, I have nothing more to say. I'm out of opinion. Thanks a lot for letting me do this.